The Dorchester was conceived as a symbol of progressive internationalism. Its internal structure, however, suggests that it was built for war. When it opened in 1932, Francis Towle's business partner, Sir Malcolm McAlpine, declared the building bomb-proof, earthquake-proof, and fire-proof. It was as if the architects had absorbed the images of the aerial wars of the future described in the fiction of H.G. Wells and cut their concrete accordingly, creating an armoured behemoth in which tomorrow's rich might sit out the firestorms. If so, they chose well. The IRA considered trying to blow the building up, but the miniaturised pen bombs they had been promised by their American allies failed to materialise, and they were obliged to content themselves with an incendiary at the Park Lane branch of the Midland Bank. The Luftwaffe proved unable to do more than break some of the hotel's windows. The Dorchester, declared the gossip columnist Bridget Chetwynd, as German bombs rained on London, is its own little self-contained and fairly bomb-proof world, where people can dine and dance, sleep and then have breakfast, without exposing themselves to the hazards of the night. In his private diary, the Canadian diplomat Charles Ritchie concurred, "I simply cannot believe that bombs would dare to penetrate this privileged enclosure, or that they could touch all these rich people. Cabinet ministers and Jewish lords are not killed in air raids. That is the inevitable illusion that this place creates." The hotel site, a triangular sliver of land on the edge of Park Lane, had been the location of Dorchester House, a vast Italianate palazzo built in 1853 by the art collector Robert Stainer Holford. In 1905, the American ambassador, Whitelaw Reid, acquired the tenancy. During the Great War, the building was refitted as a hospital for wounded servicemen. By the 1920s, it was an architectural curiosity open to the public on written application. As a child, Joyce Stone was taken there for tea and a tour of the Arboretum. She recalls her mother's fury when she informed the butler that she did not eat margarine on her bread. In September 1929, a syndicate of developers, led by McAlpine and Towle, reduced Holford's mansion to a 20,000-ton heap of disarticulated bricks, lead pipes, marble slabs, and steel girders. Once the land had been cleared, three subterranean levels were sunk deep into the earth of Mayfair and sealed with a 3-foot-thick raft of reinforced concrete. Above this, 2,000 miles of steel rods were woven, shaped, and embedded within another 50,000 tons of concrete. If anyone could be equipped with eyes of X-ray penetration, enthused McAlpine, to him, the building would appear as one huge birdcage of interlaced steel rods. And it's interesting to know that it would be a more difficult task to take this building down than it has been to build it. War rendered X-ray vision unnecessary. The solidity of the Dorchester was evidenced by the wealth and rank of the names in its booking ledger. Claridge's, a relatively fragile establishment, had rooms to spare. The future BBC newsreader Kenneth Kendall, then a young cadet officer in the Coldstream Guards, remembers that he was able to spend his leave in a pleasant 35-shilling room overlooking Brook Street. A night on Park Lane, however, was beyond his means. The Indian novelist D.F. Karaka was obliged to secure accommodation at the Dorchester by bribing the receptionist. A packet of nylon stockings bought him a camp bed in the banqueting suite. Even Cecil King, the editorial director of the Sunday Pictorial and the Daily Mirror, struggled to find a berth, and perhaps not only because his newspapers were gunning for Edward Halifax. Apparently, he noted, a lot of jittery people who do not regard their own houses as very stable have moved in there. Among them was his cousin, Esmond Harmsworth, his opposite number at the Daily Mail. Many of these bed blockers were the bodies of the British establishment most despised by the Mirror and the Pictorial. Wealthy cabinet ministers, dowager duchesses, plutocrats, bit players from the court and social column, the undeserving rich. King wrote an article for the Pictorial on the subject, Grand Hotel 1940, which was sufficiently sceptical in tone to earn him a dressing down from Malcolm McAlpine. King was not alone in his opinion. 4 weeks before the article ran, the diplomat Charles Ritchie cast an eye around the hotel and saw a luxury liner on which the remnants of London society have embarked in the midst of a storm, a fortress propped up with money bags. Cecil Beaton employed the same imagery. To him, the Dorchester was reminiscent of a transatlantic crossing in a luxury liner with all the horrors of enforced jocularity and expensive squalor. If Claridge's catered to the royal and the ministerial diaspora of Europe and the Savoy to the stars of show business and the Fourth Estate, the Dorchester too had its own constituency. They were the rich, nouveau and ancien, influential and marginal, landed and stateless. Titled, untitled, and unentitled. They had nothing in common but wealth, or a cherished history of wealth.